Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Anadaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker, Onondaga County District Attorney Lauren Fitzpatrick. Having served in Onondaga County's District Attorney's Office for over 30 years and as a defense attorney for 5 years prior to becoming the District Attorney, William J. Fitzpatrick has been involved with a variety of cases that covered every facet of the law. Sworn in as District Attorney in January of 1992, Fitzpatrick is responsible for an office of 50 assistant district attorneys, 34 investigators, and 30 support staff. A 1970 graduate of Severian High School in Brooklyn, New York, a graduate of Syracuse University in 1974, and a 1976 graduate of Syracuse University Law School, Fitzpatrick originally began working in the DA's office in March of 1975 as a law clerk. Admitted to the bar in 1977, he progressed rapidly over the next decade through the ranks of the office until in 1983, as he became Chief Assistant District Attorney, the youngest person ever appointed to this position. During his tenure, he was originally assigned to the Felony Trial Unit, assisted in the prosecution of homicide cases, handled violent felony cases, and eventually was responsible for overseeing the prosecution of all homicide cases in Onondaga County. After taking charge of the Homicide Bureau in 1983, Fitzpatrick took 20 defendants to trial for murder in a 3-year period with a conviction rate of 100%. In 1985 alone, he took 7 straight murder defendants to trial, convicted all as charged, and all 7 individuals are now serving life sentences for their crimes. As Chief Assistant District Attorney, Fitzpatrick specialized in reopening cases that had previously been considered inactive and, with the cooperation of various police agencies in Onondaga County in the state of New York, he brought numerous killers to justice in cases that were thought to be unwinnable. Fitzpatrick has lectured extensively on various topics of the criminal justice system at numerous colleges and public forums across the nation, including New York State Governor Mario Cuomo's and Governor George Pataki's law enforcement forums. He also played an instrumental role in establishing the Center for Forensic Sciences in Onondaga County, which is used statewide and has DNA testing capabilities. Fitzpatrick resides in Lafayette, New York, with his wife, the Honorable Diane Fitzpatrick, a judge on the New York State Court of Appeals. Please join me in welcoming District Attorney Fitzpatrick.
Thanks, Emily, and good morning, everybody. This is kind of weird, but I see a lot of people I know, but meeting some new friends here, too. So I'll just wave to all of you, and thanks for joining in. I hope I don't screw this up, because I have to get some kind of award. The last time I did the Thursday Morning Roundtable was 1992. So I wonder how many people you've had that have a 28-year gap in appearances. So if I do screw this up, I guess I'll see you guys again in, 2048, God willing. Thank you to my friend Sid. I don't see Sid's picture up there, but I'm sure she's there somewhere. For inviting me. Sid and I have been friends for over 40 years. I'm dating her because I was friends with Sid when she was 10 years old, I guess, because she's so young looking. But thank you for the invitation. One of the things she wanted me to talk about was the state of the criminal justice system today. And I'll talk about that later. But initially, we're in a crisis situation in the criminal justice system. And we normally have about 70 trials a year. And if a case goes to trial, one of two things usually happen, not exclusively, but usually. One, it's usually a problematic case. It might be a victim that's reluctant to testify. It might be a gang member that thinks he or she can intimidate the witnesses into not appearing and thinks they have a good shot at trial. Or the case is so heinous and so bad that we just don't make any type of offer that makes it sensible for the defendant to plead guilty. So those types of cases constitute the majority of the cases that we try. And as I said, about 70 a year. We have 4 county court parts, and we keep those judges pretty active. We have not had, let me correct myself. We have had 1 jury trial since February. So just do the math. That means we have approximately 70 trials already backed up, in addition to the trials that are going to have to be done in the normal course of business next year. Anyway, there's a new bail law, which I'll talk about later, but people are held on more serious charges because they're unable to make bail. And in some cases, they're just remanded because the crime is so bad that the people shouldn't even be out pending trial. But those people are held in the public safety building, which is about 100 yards from where I'm sitting. And regardless of whether the crime is heinous or not, it's just not fair. It's not fair to be kept locked up for that length of a period of time and not having had a single witness testify against you. I'm trying to accommodate, you know, the defense bar and the judges by some sort of innovative things that we've been doing. Certainly one of the things is disclosing all our evidence immediately. I'm trying to facilitate some pleas. Everybody, I've told the defense bar, look, you're going to get the COVID discount in terms of plea bargains if you want to avail yourself of it. And no one has availed themselves of it yet. So we're in a tough spot. The spring of 2022 or 21, I think is when we're going to get back to somewhat normal circumstances. If media reports are correct and the vaccine is readily available by early next year or late this year, God willing, we will get back to some sense of normalcy. But there's just going to be this tremendous backlog of cases. So I wish I could wave a magic wand and make everything perfect. I can't do that. We have good people, though, that are interested in making it right. And the good news about Onondaga County is that we usually, and certainly in this case, work together about that. So that's where we are right now. We have two grand juries sitting. One of them is about to expire. The other one is going to be extended. I think that's an awful lot to ask of people to come in a situation where we're doing all the CDC guidelines, we're in Office of Court Administration guidelines. The grand jurors are in a courtroom, which would normally, have a jury and a judge and witnesses and the public sitting in, and the grand jurors are separated at least 10 feet. So far, so good. We've had two grand jurors who tested positive for COVID, but not something they contracted at the courthouse. It was something related to their personal lives. And we immediately tested all the other grand jurors. They're all negative. So that grand jury is continuing to work. But I'll keep you updated about that. And hopefully we'll get through this in a good way. So what I thought I'd do is talk about five lessons that I've learned in the course of a 40 plus year career. I started as a law clerk in the DA's office in 1975. I didn't know anybody. My intent was to go back to Brooklyn and work as an assistant DA somewhere in New York City, if not Brooklyn. And met an individual by the name of John Sarando, who took a liking to me and convinced me to stay and become one of, at that time, 25 assistant DAs in Onondaga County, as opposed to one of 400 DAs in Brooklyn. And it worked out pretty well for me. Tried my first murder case in 1978. Norm Mordew was my bureau chief, who's now a federal judge. Dick Hennessy had gotten elected DA. If those of you who were around in 1976, you'll remember that the then DA got into a bit of trouble, had to resign. There was a special election, and Dick Hennessy won and decided to keep me on. I left the office, as Emily said, for about 5 years and did defense work. It's not mandatory, but I think it ought to be that every elected DA ought to have a stint for a period of time as a defense lawyer. I think it gives you a perspective that's important to your job, that, you know, not everybody belongs in jail. My philosophy has never been to, you know, just lock people up, throw away the key, I'm tough. In fact, in 92, I started a thing called PROUD, which is now commonly referred to as drug court. And people forget that we've actually had that for almost 30 years in this county. And I thought it was draconian to be sending people to state prison for, in some cases, double digit sentences for selling recreational amounts of cocaine. So I started that program and it was tremendously successful. It was the second program of its kind in the state of New York. In fact, it's now copied in all 62 counties and just about every state in the union. I had a stint as president of the National DA's Association a few years ago when I kind of imbued my philosophy on the 2,400 other prosecutors throughout America. And it's quite common to have that now. But anyway, let me just talk to you about some of the lessons I learned. And the first lesson I learned early on in trying murder cases was that, you know, my job is to speak, as I say, for those who can't. Many times it's a battered wife. It's a homicide family. It's the surviving family members of a homicide victim. Oftentimes it's a child that has no idea what has happened to him or her, other than it was terrible and it was intrusive and invasive, and someone that they loved and trusted has betrayed them. And one of the first, not first, but one of the earlier murder cases that I tried, a fellow by the name of Dwight Williams. For those of you who follow boxing, and I'm not one of them, but if you do, you'll remember a Hall of Fame boxer by the name of Michael Breland. He won a gold medal, I think, at the LA Olympics decades ago. Phenomenal career. And as I said, he was just inducted in Canastota not too long ago. So Breland needed somebody to fight, and the guy he was supposed to fight canceled, and they had to find somebody really, really quick, and they reached out to some promoters here in Syracuse, and they came up with a guy by the name of Dwight Williams to fight Breland. And he fought him at Madison Square Garden. And quite frankly, Williams was supposed to be a punching bag for Breland, who was a very charismatic, very handsome guy, and in addition to being a phenomenal boxer. And this was supposed to start his career off with a big KO. It didn't go according to script. Williams actually knocked him down in the first round. And, you know, people were gasping and horrified, you know, that we can't have this journeyman from nowhere, beat the golden boy, Mike Breland. And as it turns out, Breland won a TKO, I think in the eighth or ninth round or something. And he pretty much had his way with Williams after that. So Williams got what turned out to be the biggest purse of his life, immediately came back to Syracuse and blew most of it on cocaine and some other unsavory type things. And he wound up breaking in to the apartment of his ex-girlfriend, lived on Lincoln Avenue. And he brutally, raped her over the course of a period of time. She had her daughter and her niece were present in another room, unaware of what was happening to her. And at some point, by the grace of God, she was able to escape. And we caught Breland hours later. He was hiding in Onondaga Creek. We caught him, arrested him. And sadly, when I got to the scene, there was the bedroom where the two little girls were, was literally covered with blood. It looked like something out of a horror movie. And what had happened was the older girl had wrapped her body around the younger girl. They were 6 and 5. And so the 6-year-old wrapped her body around the 5-year-old and saved the 5-year-old's life. Williams went into a rage when he found out that his victim had escaped, and he stabbed both the little girls repeatedly, dozens of times. But by some miracle, the 5-year-old survived. So she was going to be, obviously, were she able to testify, she would have been an incredible witness, very emotional, and had a huge impact on the jury. But every time I went to interview her at Upstate, she would recoil. And then I began to notice that any time a male doctor or a male nurse would come near her, she would also recoil, and she would only allow women to be around her. So I made a strategic decision that I probably wasn't going to use her at trial. I thought I had enough physical evidence that he had left at the scene to convict him, as well as the testimony of the surviving rape victim. And the older girl died at the scene. And then this precious little five-year-old, she just hung on and hung on and hung on. So the case came to trial in front of Judge Mordew, and Michael Ratner, I don't know if anybody knows Dr. Ratner, he was this little girl's physician. So I called him to testify, to tell the jury about the injuries that this poor little girl had suffered. And literally, as we're walking from the prep room into the courtroom to have him testify, his beeper goes off. And he says, I told him not to, you know, bother me unless it was an emergency. So Judge Mordew, obviously very accommodating, said, no, doctor, go ahead and make a call. And he came back and he looked at me and his face was white. And he said, little Veronica just died. And the impact on me was, I'm getting emotional thinking about it right now, even though it was a quarter of a century ago. And I looked at the judge and defense attorney, and defense attorney said, well, I have to have a mistrial. I said, well, there's no reason for a mistrial. The jury doesn't have to be told that the little girl passed away. And we went about our business and finished the trial. And he was convicted of everything. He was convicted of her attempted murder, even though he had actually murdered her. It didn't matter. His sentence was so long. He'll die in prison. But I remember that to this day, because it taught me the lesson that's my job, is to speak for Veronica, to speak for her who can't speak in a courtroom. And that's what a good DA should be doing, you know, speak for the victims. I think maybe not unfairly, but factually, that we focus on the defendants. We focus on their lives. We focus on, you know, well, why did the person do this? What was wrong with his or her character, upbringing, so forth and so on. And we sometimes forget that the little Veronicas of this world and the victims. So that's one of the first lessons that I learned. Second lesson I want to talk about is decisions that I make have consequences, and not just me, but prosecutors make. May 4th, 1980, there's a young kid named Tommy Newman, and he was working at the U-Haul station over off of 690. I think it's by Teal. It's still there. And he was working on a Sunday. He was going to be married in 2 weeks. Tommy was, I think, 24, 25 years old. Good kid. Working alone. And three guys came in on that Sunday afternoon, and they marched him into a little bathroom, probably 6 foot by 6 foot, made him stand in the corner and put a .22 caliber bullet in his head and killed him, even though he had been completely cooperative with these guys and given them the money. They cut the phone lines, and very professional job. I said three went in. Actually, there were three robbers, but only two actually went in. So anyway, it went unsolved for quite a period of time. And it wasn't my case, because although I had been doing homicide cases, I wasn't assigned to that bureau. It was another DA's case. So that DA got a call about a year later that there's a guy down in North Carolina that had committed a robbery, and he wanted to talk about a robbery / homicide that he had information on in Syracuse. So that DA and a number of police officers drove down to North Carolina, along with a defense lawyer, I might add, and they negotiated a deal with this character. His name was Charles Philip Bond. And the deal they worked out was that Bond was going to get 15 years in North Carolina for the robbery that he had committed there. So the prosecutor agreed that Bond would get 15 years concurrent, i.e. at the same time, for the robbery homicide in Syracuse. I thought that was ridiculous. I thought it was, you know, might as well give the guy a present and a cake and a party. I complained to Norm Mordew, but he said, no, you know, that's the best we can do. At least we're going to get the other two guys. And then something really strange happened. As they were driving back, they got to about Virginia, Bond says, hey, pull over. There's something I want to tell you. He had alleged that he was the getaway driver, and the other two guys went in. He named the shooter. He named the accomplice who went in and actually robbed Tommy. And as they pulled over to this rest area somewhere in Virginia, he says, I lied. I pulled the trigger. I was the shooter. And they went ahead with the deal anyway. I never prosecuted the other two guys. So 2 years later, Norm retired. He went to the bench, and Dick Hennessy put me in charge of the Homicide Bureau. And I said, you know, I'm going to get those other two guys. And I did. I wound up convicting the other two guys, used Bond as a witness, which was nauseating, but that's the deal he made. Convicted both of them. They're both actually serving longer sentences than Bond did for that crime. But why do I say that I learned about consequences? Well, about 20 years ago, I got a call from a prosecutor in North Carolina, and he said, do you know a guy by the name of Charles Philip Bond? And I said, well, I said, I wouldn't call him an acquaintance, but I certainly know who he is. And Bond had been involved in a robbery. He had been paroled after he had served his time in North Carolina, and he owed no time in New York because it was a concurrent sentence. He committed another robbery and another homicide, and he killed a young man in North Carolina. And this is not a polemic for the death penalty. Media characterizes me often as like a big proponent of the death penalty. That's silly. That's just not accurate. I have sought the death penalty in one case. I think it was appropriate, James Cahill, for those of you that remember that. But again, I'm not diverting to talk about the death penalty, but the lesson that I learned is consequences. I actually went down to North Carolina with Tommy's mother, and we testified at the penalty phase, and Bond was put on death row by a multiracial jury in North Carolina, and he still sits there. He's still on death row in North Carolina. Had he been properly dealt with in New York, he would never have been at liberty to have killed that young man that he did in North Carolina. The third lesson I've learned over the course of my career is to have an open mind. I can't tell you how many times I've seen law enforcement will focus on a case and say, look, this is the guy that did it. And we've got blinders on now. And any evidence that points to his guilt, that's great. We'll put that in the pot. Anything over here that might point to somebody else, well, we'll leave that for another day. And that's a terrible philosophy to have. And the one case that really brought that to my mind, to have an open mind, I have a cold case task force. What we do is we meet periodically, probably once a month, and we will have a case assigned to a detective for the agency that's handling the investigation. And that detective's responsibility is to do in 15, 20, 30 minutes, a presentation about the facts of the case. And then this group of individuals, we will sit down and we will brainstorm. Did we look at this piece of evidence? Did we interview that witness? Did we check this, and so forth and so on? And believe me, today it is so different than it was when I started, when I tried my first murder case 40 years ago, in terms of evidence, what you look for. You know, you look for cell phones and video cameras and electronic information, Facebook postings and things like that, which we never did before because they didn't exist. But the case that was on this particular day years ago was the death of Marion Fisher. She was a phys ed teacher at JD, very, very sweet woman, married to Jack Fisher. They had two kids. And on this particular night, the night we believe that she was killed, Jack and Marion had a neighbor babysat the two kids at a different home. And they went to a restaurant in DeWitt to celebrate their anniversary along with some other couples. Jack gets a knock on the door the next morning. He's asleep on the couch. I'll explain why in a second. And the police say, "Where's your wife?" And he says, "Well, I assume she's upstairs asleep." But what had happened was the night before, Marion and Jack got into an argument, God knows about what. And Marion stormed out of the restaurant and said, "Well, I'm walking home." It was about a mile, maybe a mile and a half from the restaurant. And Jack said, "Fine." And he stayed at the bar and had another couple of drinks. And the other couples eventually left. They, you know, felt uncomfortable and embarrassed and so forth and so on. Jack gets home. He doesn't want to exacerbate the argument, so he goes to sleep on the couch. Remember, the kids aren't home. And then he gets that knock on the door. The police take him down to the station house, and He starts saying goofy things. His alibi begins to fall apart because when he says he got home is inconsistent with what a couple of neighborhood kids say they saw him getting home. He begins to say goofy things like, well, you know, maybe I blacked out. Maybe I did something. He takes a lie detector test and he fails it miserably. And he wasn't arrested. This was 1975. I was a law student, had nothing to do with the case back then. And it just lingered and lingered and lingered. And when it came up at the cold case task force meeting, the first thing the Syracuse cop says is, we know that Jack did it. We just can't prove it. And then one of the little DNA eggheads raises her hand and says, Bill, maybe we should test this towel or rag, whatever it was found by the body. It doesn't look like it should have been there. She was found in the woods right near Lafayette Country Club. So we test that rag. She calls me a couple of days later and says, you're not going to believe it. We got a full DNA profile. When he had raped Marion and then strangled her with her own stocking, he must have wiped himself off with this rag and then just discarded it in 1975, not having any idea that that could come back to haunt him. I said, oh my goodness, that's great. I said, do we have Jack Fisher's profile? We can compare it and then we've got a good case. She said, we don't need that because we ran the profile through the National DNA Databank and it came back to a guy by the name of Carlton Gary, who is at that time was on death row in Georgia for killing 16 women. And his nickname was the Stocking Strangler. He just happened to be, he had a cousin in Syracuse. He just happened to be here for a couple of weeks walking through an area and sadly ran into Marion, accosted her, raped her, and strangled her to death. And you can imagine how emotional that call was that I made to Jack Fisher to tell him, hey, Jack, you don't know me, but I got to tell you something. We know who killed Marion. And he was really reluctant to talk to me at first, but we actually then became kind of pals, talked a number of times. In fact, he called me 2 weeks later after I had first told him the news, and I could hear all this noise in the background, kids playing, and you could hear it sounded like Christmas, even though it was in the spring. I said, Jack, what's going on? You having a party or something? He says, no, that's my daughter who hasn't spoken to me in 20 years because she thinks I killed her mother. And that's her grandchildren. That's my grandchildren, her children, who I've never even met. And I just still get emotional thinking about that. And even though it was, you know, a quarter of a century too late, it's never too late to do the right thing. And we did right eventually by Jack Fisher to reunite him with his family. But I learned that lesson. Always keep an open mind, be a critical thinker. And the fourth thing is always attend to details. Criminal cases can rise or fall on the smallest things. A drop of blood that appears out of place. Was the door locked? What phone was used? Where did the people stand? Is there gunshot residue? So forth and so on. It literally just a million things. But when people ask me, who's the most evil guy you ever prosecuted? The first name that always pops into my mind is Mad Dog Allen. I prosecuted him years ago. And he had been involved. He had been a suspect in 8 homicides and never been charged. And finally, on my watch was homicide number 9. His live-in girlfriend, her name was Lorraine Marshall. And Lorraine was a professional woman. Mad Dog was a professional criminal. And you talk about opposites attracting, but whatever. I can't undo 2 million years of evolution. They developed a relationship and started living together, and they had a little boy, James Jose Allen. And we came to her West Side apartment one day, and there she was, stabbed to death, stabbed 36 times on a waterbed. And the waterbed was never punctured. So you know a couple of things right off the bat. This is not a burglary. This is not a sex crime. This is somebody who is absolutely psychotic, passionate, enraged, and it's personal. This is not some random, you know, thief who happened upon Lorraine and decided to stab her 36 times. And the really tragic thing was little James, who had just had his seventh birthday, was missing. So this began really one of the most intensive searches in the history of Syracuse. Little James's picture was on milk cartons, buses, on the news every night. And we had this massive effort to try to find this little boy. And of course, Mad Dog was a suspect, and for good reason. And I began to develop a case, and I began to look at the evidence. And again, the nation stages of forensics, there wasn't a lot, there wasn't any DNA employed back then. But nevertheless, I began to put a fairly good case against Mad Dog together. Now, he was picked up 2 weeks after the crime on a parole violation, and he agreed to be interviewed. And the cops talked to him for, as I recall, it was at least 6 hours, maybe longer, with his lawyer sitting right there. Mad Dog loved to talk. And he had this really voice to die for, like a James Earl Jones voice, very, very articulate, very deep, very resonant. And it just filled the room. And cop after cop would come out and say, I can't take it anymore. I can't. This guy's wearing me down. He denied any involvement in the death. And we were still looking for little James at that point. 2 weeks after Mad Dog's interview, which would have been 4 weeks after the murder, a guy was looking for, an artist was looking for driftwood by Onondaga Lake. And he came upon, sadly, little James's body. He had washed ashore, still wearing the little jacket that he had gotten for his seventh birthday. And cause of death is he had been strangled, and then somebody just threw him, probably in Onondaga Creek, and his body washed into Onondaga Lake and eventually came upon the shore. So about, 7, 8 months later, the case went to trial. I played all 6 hours of the videotape of Mad Dog, and the jury was, very attentive, but 6 hours is 6 hours. It's tough to keep their attention. And after about a 4 month trial, we then began to sum up. And I took the ancient VHS tape recorder and I pushed it in front of the jury, and you could see them visibly react. They rolled their eyes, much like a lot of you reacted when you found out I was the guest speaker earlier this morning. But, they said, oh God, we got to listen to 6 hours of this. This is torture. And I said to them, I said, relax. Not only am I not going to play 6 hours, I'm going to play about 15 seconds. And no one had ever picked up on this before. No, the cops didn't pick up on it. Certainly the defense lawyer didn't pick up on it. The judge didn't pick up on it. And I hit the play button, and Jerry Sobloski, a retired Syracuse sergeant now, looked at Mad Dog and he said, what do you think about your son? He was a very important part of my life. And I hit the stop button. And I looked at the jury and I said, now you listened during the trial to Mad Dog talk for 6 hours. He never stuttered one single time except in answer to that question, because he said the word was. When the entire community was looking for little James, his own father referred to him in the past tense. And realizing his mistake, he stuttered over the word, but he couldn't take it back. And there it is. The judge told me later that the hair stood up on the back of his head. He said, that was it. So I finished my summation. And after a 4 month trial, the jury went out, deliberated about 4 hours, convicted Mad Dog. And I write him letters every now and then, would you like to come clean and tell us where your, where your earlier wife, where you buried her, because she disappeared on Christmas Eve in 1983, I think, or 82. And we know he did it. We just can't prove it. And I remember my earlier admonition about keeping an open mind, but Mad Dog's the worst of the worst. And that always taught me, pay attention to details, however small they may be. And you can never over prepare a case. So the final thing I'll talk to you about is I never give up. I don't think that it's, that there's no time frame on justice for someone, whether it's to exonerate someone who was wrongfully convicted, whether it's to free somebody like Jack Fisher from undue burden of suspicion, or whether it's to bring, and I never use the word closure. Closure is a really dumb word. There's no such thing as closure when you've lost a loved one to homicidal means. You can reach a certain level of peace and resolution, but there's no closure in that. So I don't use that word, but I like to give people the satisfaction of knowing that somebody did something horrible to one of their loved ones is going to pay the price. So a woman by the name of Barbara Kilbourne, she lived over on Seymour Street, and she was in government subsidized housing, and found her body one morning, and obviously based on the position of her clothing, which had been wrapped up all the way to her neck and all the way down to her ankles. It was a suspected sexual assault and a strangulation homicide. And Barbara was schizophrenic. One of the people that, you know, we all talk about in American society, but we never really want to do anything for, to help. And you kind of look the other way when you see these people and so forth and so on. So she, it was a sad story. And the media, let me, before I jump ahead to the media, I began investigating that case, but then I left the office for a period of time and it went cold. I found out when I took office that 2 years earlier, a fingerprint had been identified by a new automated system that they have in New York. And the fingerprint was found on groceries that were on the kitchen counter in Barbara's apartment. And I said, well, what did we do about the fingerprint? And the honest answer was nothing. The DA's office had done nothing. The police had done nothing. They identified the print and it went on a shelf somewhere. I said, well, that's completely unacceptable. So what I did was I began to earnestly look at that guy, and I brought the family in, and I told the family what I had intended to do. And apparently a couple of months later, they got dissatisfied with the pace that I was moving at and went to a columnist for the local paper, who wrote this scathing article about me, that if you were rich, and he even mentioned the case, Jim Pippins, who is the millionaire killed by Cynthia Pugh, if you're rich, you get Fitzpatrick's attention, but if you're poor, like Barbara Kilbourne, he just doesn't care. You know, a great narrative, sexy, appealing, you know, the David Goliath type thing, and the evil of, you know, the prosecutor and so on. And to this day, I don't think I've ever read a more insidious piece of garbage in my life. It's just a totally false narrative. And yeah, I brought the family back in and I said, you know, you gotta trust me. Why are you, you know, you want to take your story to the media? I said, now you're out of the loop when things happen and I'm just not going to share them with you. And they, you know, continued their bitterness and so forth and so on. And eventually, I was able to get DNA. As I told you, Barbara had been raped. And we found a full DNA profile. We surreptitiously got a DNA sample from the person whose fingerprint that was, a guy by the name of Eddie Kithcart. And I took Eddie Kithcart to trial, and I convicted him. His defense was, yeah, I knew her, but it was consensual sex, and I don't know what happened to her after I left. Well, jury didn't buy that justifiably, and they convicted him. And the nice thing was that, of course, the columnist, you know, I expected, well, he's going to write, you know, some glowing article about how I never give up and how he was wrong. Well, that, of course, never happened. But I still have about 15 feet from where I'm sitting right now, I have this plaque from Barbara's family that they gave to me as a token of appreciation. And it's just a small little thing, but it means the world to me. And that's the fifth life lesson, in addition to a lot of others that I've learned about, you know, never giving up. So we could talk now about anything you want. Emily, you can screen the questions. Nothing, I shouldn't say screen. Anybody, you can ask me anything about anything. I hope we get a chance to talk about some of the myths you hear about the criminal justice system. Probably the biggest is mass incarceration, and all we do is we lock up low-level drug dealers. Number of people that I've sent to state prison for marijuana in 40 years, one. Well, okay, but that's too many. One. No, not really. This guy had he had about 100 pounds of marijuana, which is, you know, an ounce, 100 pounds, whatever. But he had been on trial for homicide in Arizona a few years before he got arrested here. And his case was dismissed because the main witness against him died of natural causes, as I like to say, when the machete that went through his heart caused his bodily functions to stop. I thought that's a guy that probably deserves to be in state prison, even though he was never charged with the murder. He's the only person that had any motive to kill that poor young guy. And so it was kind of, even though it was, in my mind, it was a little justice for the kid in Arizona. We just don't lock up low-level drug dealers. I announced about 18 months ago that because the legislature keeps dickering around about what they're going to do with marijuana. I don't prosecute marijuana cases. It's still against the law. It's still illegal. But I just don't prosecute them. I've never differentiated between crack and powder cocaine. I think the racial disparity as a result of those prosecutions are unfair and not based in good public policy. In terms of mass incarceration, the prison population pre-pandemic in the state of New York in the last 15 years is down 30%. African-American male population down 12%. Safety. New York, again, pre-pandemic, not now, but pre-pandemic, was the safest large state in America. So we're reducing our prison population while at the same time keeping New York safe. Obviously, when you put those two things together, when the new crowd of progressives got to Albany, the first thing they had to do was reform that system. Okay, why would we reform one system that is actually working pretty well for the benefit of most New Yorkers? And now we no longer can lay claim to the safest large state in America. In Syracuse, New York, we've had in the last calendar year, 140% increase in shootings with injury. That's a staggering statistic, 140%. And, you know, people say, well, it's because of the pandemic. No, it has nothing to do with the pandemic. People are staying home with the pandemic. Crime, you know, shoplifting and larceny offenses, to some extent, are down because of the pandemic. We've had this storm of raise the age, bail reform, and there's just lack of respect for law enforcement. I totally agree with the governor. In fact, I'm chairing I'm chairing a committee locally to, I don't want to use the word reinvent, but to reassess policing, use of force, mental illness, training for cops, and so forth and so on. So I hope we're going to have some good news out of that. The governor's deadline is next April, and I'm again, totally in favor of that, but not defunding or dismantling a police department. Anyway, I've chatted longer than I thought I would be able to. Emily, fire away.
All right, great. We have our first question. So I'm just going to quote the person. In current times, they'd like to hear about your philosophy regarding Black Lives Matter and other social matters facing our communities. Can the DA's office support and create a bridge from these groups and police agencies you work with?
Very, very non-controversial, simple question. I just had my secretary call me. I'll be back. No. Black Lives Matter, small letters. Well, you'd be an idiot not to endorse that. Of course, Black Lives Matter. But then if you say all lives matter, well, why are you saying that? Are you saying that because of racial animus, or are you saying that because you really believe it, and so forth and so on? So small letters, Black Lives Matter, 100%. I think anybody that disagrees, has anybody ever met a smart racist? No one talks about the correlation between abject stupidity and racism. But anyway, I'll leave that for another topic. Capital letters, Black Lives Matter, is a Marxist organization that I would have a very, very little tolerance or desire to endorse their philosophies. They don't believe in the family unit. They don't believe in capitalism. They don't believe in America. And that's not me. That's them. That's on their website. Now, with that said, there's this overlap, this mixture of people who are genuinely committed to, you know, why is it that an officer sits for 8 minutes and 47 seconds on a man's chest who's begging for his life? Why does that happen? Why do we allow that to happen? So if you believe that that is intolerable, unacceptable, horrendous, and criminal, and you want to say, you want to wear a t-shirt that says Black Lives Matter, would I embrace that person? Of course I would. I've talked to some of them. I've had some of my assistant DAs join the protest march on their own volition, not directed by me, but on completely on their own regarding the George Floyd murder. And what was the other part of the question, Emily, about a bridge or something?
Bridging to your office.
You know, I answer every email that I get. I answer every phone call that I get. And if people want to, you know, people want to meet with me, absolutely, you know, bridging and talking. We fully expect to have full community engagement in the governor's process of, as he said, to reinvent the police departments. My attitude as the unofficial chair of that is inclusion, not exclusion. The more people that want to be heard. You know, I don't want to hear that, you know, you got a speeding ticket on the throughway and you were only doing, you know, 75, not 85. I don't, and the cop was rude to you. I'm not interested in that. If you have a specific instance where, you know, a police encounter was uncomfortable, was dangerous, was inappropriate. Yeah. I want to hear about that and make things better. I hope I answered that question. I don't.
Thank you. Next question. Is as much effort spent in the prosecution on white collar crimes versus violent crimes? Why or why not?
Oh, that's a good, that's a good question. When I took office, we had no specific bureau devoted to economic crimes. I now have Melanie Cardin, and I mentioned her because she's an all-star. She's the bureau chief of what I call the Rackets Bureau. And I have a very, very aggressive approach. Now, do we put the same time and effort into it? I don't know. It's a different cat because, you know, it's tedious. It's boring. It's computer work. It's records. It's going over ledgers and checks and banks and so forth and so on. And that is time consuming. But fortunately, I have a group of retired IRS agents from a state grant, and they work very closely with Melanie in what I call the Rackets Bureau. And one of the things that incenses me is police officers generally have this tendency to say, oh, that's a civil matter. You know, and I've stopped that. I stopped that decades ago where, you know, you give X amount of dollars of your hard-earned money to Contractor Jones. Contractor Jones then disappears, doesn't do a thing, doesn't put a nail in a piece of wood or raise a hammer or anything. And that's supposed to be a civil matter. That's not a civil matter. That's thievery. And I prosecuted lots of people like that. I prosecuted people for labor law violations. We had one guy that was trafficking undocumented immigrants into Syracuse, paying them cash at sub-minimum wage and, you know, whatever horrible or, you know, just poor squalor that they would be able to get by on. And I prosecuted that guy very, very aggressively because I thought he was a scumbag, and also reached out to the people that he was exploiting and tried to get them assistance as well. So yes, I don't know if I said yes, or the question was, do we pursue them with as much effort? And I guess it's yes, but with a different focus.
Great, thank you. So I'm getting a couple questions about bail reform. So can you just talk about, you know, where you think it's getting something right, where it's wrong, and
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Emily, but bail reform, as soon as I heard the two words. Yeah, bail reform is a good thing overall. And what prosecutors asked was that it just be tweaked a little bit. And let me give you an example of what I mean by that. Nobody should be held in jail for a nonviolent crime because they can't make bail. That's been my philosophy for 20 years. Alison Feinberg, God rest her soul, She used to be in charge, and I have somebody else in charge of it now. But we review the jail list every week. And I don't, I tell you one thing I have in common with all of you. I've never set bail in my life. It's amazing how prosecutors always get blamed for bail and sentences. And we never do any of them. We don't sentence people and we don't set bail. But with that said, I would look, and some of the judges just don't get it. They're, you know, well, oh, you're speeding in the town council, $50 bail. And I've got some kids sitting over here for, you know, 2 days who's committed, you know, a traffic offense or a petty larceny or some nonviolent type thing or possession of a minor amount of recreational use drugs. And we would immediately go to a superior court judge and get those people out. Now, what the legislature has done is they have codified that into a statute. Our point was you made a couple of mistakes. You didn't include residential burglaries as a bailable offense. They corrected that. You didn't consider domestic violence cases. To some extent, they've corrected that. You didn't consider a future dangerousness. You know, people, a lot of people go from DEFCON 5 to DEFCON 1 without hitting 4, 3, or 2. And, you know, prosecutors have a pretty, you know, should Jeff Cahill have been out on bail? You know, no, he shouldn't have been, but he was, because he was, you know, a rich white guy from Skinny Atlas. But that's another story. So my point is that the bail reform was good, but it needs to be amended just a little bit, not to keep poor people in jail. I've got a guy, he's the porch pirate. He's been convicted 55 times. You know how hard it is to convict somebody 55 times? With the amount of programs and diversions and leniency that we show in the criminal justice system. This guy just got sentenced to a whopping 20 days after he committed 5 more independent petty larcenies. Each one he'd come back, the judge would say, yeah, I better not see you again. Out on bail. 2, out on bail. 3, 4, 5. He just got released, and we've got a warrant for his arrest now because it's Christmas time. Now he's a porch pirate. You know, he just loves to go around. That guy should not be out on bail. So bail reform, a very, very good thing, needs some minor adjustments. It could be made a lot better and keep us a lot safer.
Great, thank you. Introduction, we talked about how you have ADAs in your office. So what are they doing during this COVID shutdown? You talked about there's not many trials happening. So what are they doing in the meantime?
The ADAs, well, cases are still coming in. We still have to put them in the grand jury. We still have to comply with the new discovery laws. So trust me, they're very, very busy. The only thing that we still have virtual appearances, much like we're doing now. We'll have the defendant. There's a camera over in the Justice Center. We're doing, you know, arraignments. We're doing preliminary hearings. We're still doing pretrials. So they're busy.
Great, thank you. You talked about this briefly. We have a question. What efforts are being made to address police profiling of Black and Brown people in Onondaga County?
That's a good question. If those of you who can remember, when Dennis Duval was police chief, and Dennis and I have been friends since college, he was a little more known than I was in college, and I was a little jealous of him in college. I'm still jealous of him. But in any event, Dennis and I are very, very close friends. I only mentioned that, I don't know, I don't even know why I mentioned it. Anyway, when he became police chief, we started together the first racial profiling data system in Onondaga County. Why are you pulling someone over? I have an assistant DA who is African-American male, and he runs my Special Victims Bureau, and he lives out in the suburbs. And we had a chat a couple of months ago, and it wasn't an eye opener for me, but it was important. It was an important conversation to have because we had had an office function, and he had been pulled over on the way home. And you can talk all you want. I know this kid. He doesn't speed. He doesn't, you know, drive some like ridiculously flashy car. Who cares if he did? And, it's a problem. It's a problem. Driving while Black is a real issue. And, you know, I look at the, I had a case the other day that a lawyer came in to see me on, and a kid was pulled over and he had a minor amount of marijuana. And I won't tell you the kid's name because the case has been disposed of and sealed. But he was a high profile kid, African-American kid, high profile. And he was also Canadian. So I looked at the case and I said, you know, there's no reason. This kid wasn't pulled over because he was doing 35 and a 30. We don't pull people over for doing 35 and 30. Now, don't everybody take that away. You know, say Fitzpatrick said, I can drive 10% over the limit. He's pulled over because it was late at night. He had a nice car and he was African-American. And I called the chief of the guy and I said, look, this cop is on my radar. You know, if he's going to continue to make arrests, they better be clean and they better be right. And they better be because of constitutional and penal law reasons, not because he's having a slow day and some black kid is driving through the suburbs. So I mentioned Dennis Duval. Now we have Kent Buckner. Buckner is a home run. He and I are working on the same type of issues regarding profiling, reinventing policing. And I guess to answer the questioner's call, it's something I'm hip to, I'm aware of, I'm trying to address with training. And when I see a case and someone says to me, my client was pulled over because of his or her skin color, it's not something I dismiss as out of hand.
Thank you. Next question, do you work with local FBI folks? And if so, what kinds of cases are you working on?
Yeah, you know, you can have there's cross jurisdiction. The feds are the feds. You know, we always put on a nice game face when we arrest somebody, but behind the scene, there's a lot of infighting, a lot of jealousy, a lot of turf wars. I don't really tolerate that crap. The local special agent in charge used to be an assistant DA of mine. He's a great guy. And he's a great friend. But on narcotics cases, bank robberies, kidnappings, things that cross state lines, there's cross jurisdiction. There's no written rule that says this is a federal case, this is a state case. We just work it out. It's usually me and the United States attorney. We have a new United States attorney who I've actually known. She's not from Syracuse, but I've actually known her personally. I know her by reputation. I'm sure we'll have the same relationship that I've had with the previous U.S. attorneys. And usually you look at, okay, who's got the better venue? Who can get more bang for the buck? If it's a serious crime, who can get more time for the individual? Like David Renge, remember that oh God, animal that he raped? He raped a little 9-year-old girl and killed the girl's mother. Remember that? They were coming out of a dance class at the Great Northern Mall, and he stalked them and then just hit that. That had cross jurisdiction because it was a kidnapping. So we got life without parole, and the only question was, will the feds get the death penalty? And they, I think at that time, it was Eric Holder, and he decided not to seek the death penalty, so that was the end of the case. William Wood, the guy at Chili's that executed the two people, tried to execute two other people. That case has been disposed of on the state side with life without parole, but the federal government is seeking the death penalty. The Justice Department's attitude on the death penalty may change with the new administration, and that may be the end of the Wood case, but I can't say that for sure. So we work closely with them, and we'll continue to, always will.
Great. Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. So I just want to thank you again for coming to speak with us.
Yes. I wish I had more time to talk to folks. My email is very simple. It's my name, William Fitzpatrick, @ongov. That's Onondaga Government, ONGOV.net. And if I don't respond to your email, that means I'm a liar because I just said 20 minutes ago that I respond to every email. So I enjoyed this. Thank you, Emily. And everybody stay safe, have a beautiful holiday, and God willing, it won't take you 28 years to invite me back. And when we do it, I see people saying, yeah, it should be 30 years before we write. But if we do do it, we can hopefully do it in person.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Emily. God bless everybody.
Bye.
And thank you, Sid, wherever you are.